Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed. Except, of course, for today, this episode, which is actually one I recorded a while ago, actually, not just with me. It's a discussion between me and the guys from the SFF Audio podcast. So check it out, the book that we're reviewing and discussing quite a lot of details, actually, called Earth Abides. We go on for quite a long time about this one. I actually recorded this a while ago. It was a very late night or very early morning recording for me. It was late night because I stayed up 4 o'clock in the morning. I was there because Scott from SFF Audio, he was like, that's the only time he has free. And I was like, yeah, I'll just stay up. I don't mind staying up. I was having lots of late nights anyway, so it didn't make too much of a difference. And then Scott didn't even finish the book. So then we recorded it at 4 o'clock in the morning for me until about 6 o'clock in the morning. And he wasn't even there. And he was the one who had scheduled it in that way. Anyway, so we did this and that was like 2 Sundays ago. And it's been released now on the SFF Audio site, but I said I'd release it here as a podcast. And I've done another podcast since then, since recording this one. And actually the next podcast that I'm going to be doing is Starship Mutiny by Mike Resnick. I'm about an hour away from the end of that audio book, probably a bit less actually now, and I'll probably finish that off this evening and do the review this evening or tomorrow, probably not tomorrow, maybe the next day, because actually tomorrow I'm going on holiday. I'm going to New York for 4 weeks. It's a real proper holiday. I'm not going there for any reason of like no gigs, no travel or anything like that. It's just I'm going to be in New York for 4 weeks. So if you're from there and you've got advice about what to do or what not to do or different things like that, I've got 4 weeks to fill. And hopefully it's going to be a really relaxing and interesting time. Otherwise, email me, luke@juggler.net. Otherwise, that's around about it. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. It is quite long, and I'll catch up with you guys later. See you then.
This is the SFF Audio Podcast.
Hey, this is Jesse.
My name is Luke.
And I'm Greg Marguerite.
How's it going, guys?
Good.
I'm doing okay. A little bit disappointed with the timing of this podcast recording. I wasn't expecting to be up at 4 o'clock in the morning,
sorry,
but
about
here
that.
I am. No problem.
We've got to get a time that works for all people on all planets in all time zones.
Yeah, well, next month I'm going to be in New York. I'm going on holiday to New York for a month, so for next month I'd actually be more in better time zones if we'd have just waited for a week or something. But hey, we got to get it in sometime.
That's right. And we're going to talk about Earth Abides by George R. Stewart, right?
Yep. That's the idea.
I thought this was going to be a good book, and I was surprised. It is an excellent book, I think. What do you guys think?
Well, lots of people have actually recommended this book to me because I just read and reviewed Lucifer's Hammer. No, not Lucifer's Hammer. Yes, Lucifer's Hammer. And lots of people said, oh, that's all sort of like, you know, them people rebuilding or trying to rebuild after sort of like a post-apocalyptic kind of event. And loads of people said, oh, but it's no way as good as Earth Abides. Earth Abides did sort of post-apocalyptic living better than anything. So this, for me, was recommended in a like as the best post-apocalyptic novel that there is. And to be honest, I was really, really impressed with that. I really enjoyed it too. I mean, it's the first time I've read it, and I thought it was amazing.
It lives up to the hype, I think.
It's one of those few books which people literally were saying, this is the best of its kind. And I actually can see their point, even though I haven't really thought about it, because I'm not really good at saying, this is the best book of its kind.
It's definitely a lost classic. I've been reading, I'll let Greg speak in a minute, but I've been reading a lot of science fiction for a lot of years, and I keep thinking, well, you know, I've read all the greats. Maybe one day someone will write another great book, and I'll be able to read that, but I guess I've read all the greats in the past, so what can you do? And
I know I have not read all the greats in the past.
Well, that's the way I'm looking at it, right? And usually when people mention a book, I think, it's probably a book I'll read at some point. But this one had sort of been completely off my radar. What's your opinion, Greg?
I read it, when I was like 13 years old. So, you know, and it was great to reread it again. I got a whole new thing about it that I didn't pick up the first time. But the thing that impresses me the most about it is that the exposition is extremely calm. And that's what freaks you out about it. That's what keeps the tension going.
Yeah.
He very calmly and methodically describes what's going on as if he were an impassioned observer, but you know he's not.
That's what he tries to set himself out up as. He's just all right, I'm going to be a student of history, of the history of the time after this. And he tries to detach himself from a lot of...
You're talking about the main character, right?
The main character. Williams. And we spend so much time in his head that that's what we're getting. That's the tone.
It's pretty much his point of view. But it does, especially early in the book, it switches out and, you know, talks about things outside of what the character knows.
Yeah, it's very vivid and deeply imagined. I didn't mean to take away from, you know, I mean, I just think that the primary reaction I've heard people have to this book is that it's really sad. And I didn't have that reaction, but I was trying to understand what the sad horror of it was. And I thought that the calm method of exposition, just laying out the facts very simply, page after page, is what's really scary about it.
Well, the Isherwood becomes depressed at some point in a book, you know.
Well, let's set it up, because we're just talking about this, and probably a lot of people know. So let's set it up. So it starts off with Isherwood. What's his
Williams,
name? Isherwood?
I think.
Williams.
Yeah.
Otherwise known as Ish to himself. So he's out in the hills, and he's a student. What's he actually studying? Is he studying history?
Geography.
That's it. Yeah. But I wasn't quite sure what he was exactly what he was studying. But he picks up. He's just found this hammer, and as he finds a hammer, he's like, "Oh, this is pretty good." But as he picks it up, a snake bites him. A rattlesnake bites him. So he has to suddenly deal with this rattlesnake bite out in the country, and it just so happens that suddenly a worldwide pandemic or epidemic or whatever it's called sweeps across the entire world and wipes out like all but a very, very small handful of people. And he's just there, and I think he thinks it's something to do with being bitten by a rattlesnake is what sort of like made his body, as he was fighting the rattlesnake, or the rattlesnake poison cancelled out.
Or maybe an immune reaction or something, right?
Yeah, kind of immune reaction. It's not exactly explained, but...
I love that it's not explained. I love that, he mentions it, and then get another example.
A bit
and say,
later.
Oh, well, maybe, and then it's just left unknown, because we'll never know.
Yeah, and...
Yeah, go ahead.
Carry on, Jared. No, Greg, go.
Oh, I was just going to say, that's something that... You know, I've had this discussion before with people about what, you know, how do you define science fiction, and I say there has to be a speculative idea, and it has to be integral to the plot, but it doesn't have to be a big deal. You don't have to give me all the nuts and bolts, and you don't get any nuts and bolts. You know, if you think about like Flowers for Algernon, the operation that makes him smart is like a half a page. You have no detail about it at all. But if you take away that operation, the whole book falls apart.
Yep.
And that's what makes that science fiction. And I think that this is another good example of that. There aren't much in the way of nuts and bolts here, but if you
ecological nuts and bolts, but not to what particularly caused the disaster, right?
He has philosophical nuts and bolts, but
but also the nuts and bolts are sort of like I mean, maybe it's not a science fictional thing, but it's the extrapolation from like what would the society, well, not the society, what would the world be like, you know, and how the world crumbles apart and how everything, you know. That's sort of an outgrowth of this thing, but I think that's very science fictional in a way. Like all of the extrapolation afterwards, I think is.
I agree. What I meant was that he doesn't try and figure out was it a virus and get a microscope and get some tissue and that.
Yeah.
I mean, nuts and bolts. I mean, there's very little science in the science fiction, but there is this germ of an idea that is not gone into in great deal.
I understand, but I'm saying that the science part is how he talks about what the world would be like afterwards. I think there's a lot of science and a lot of very good observation there, and a lot of but like you say, the central crisis, which you could say is sort of like this worldwide epidemic or pandemic, you're right, it is sort of like left unexplained, and how the people survived is also left unexplained. I do like it how some of them are going, hey, oh, have you ever been bitten by a rattlesnake? And everyone's going, no. And then some people are like, yeah, I was. And they're like, ah, maybe that's it. And other people are like, no, no rattlesnakes here. And then you're like, oh, maybe it isn't the rattlesnakes. So that's a little theme throughout the book, too.
Yeah, I
was just going to say, the the science part of it for me, beyond the disease itself, which we don't get a lot of, is a combination of the social psychology of the characters, of how, what people are like. And I think I understand people better after reading this book, which is saying something, right? It's not like you go into a book and, you know, you come away changed every time. When a book changes my opinion a little bit or my outlook a little bit, then I think that's a powerful book. And so in that way, I think it worked. But also the world would be like when the people are gone. He talks a lot about how the plagues of locusts come, the plagues of rats, and how they're all related to the breeding cycles. And that is all kind of like hard biological science fiction, if there's such a thing, right?
Yeah, there's lots of supporting arguments for the ramifications. Like, if you remember, lice disappear because they are so dependent on us.
That was almost poetry there. Almost poetry. I mean,
And I like how the common cold disappears as well, because there's not enough people to pass it around and to keep it going. Whereas everyone gets measles, you know, it's just everyone does, you know, and it's one of those strange, you know, these little other diseases that come up and go. And then there's before the mice, before the rats, there's the ants as well. And suddenly there's ants everywhere. And suddenly one day they're all just gone.
Yeah.
Which is actually a really great sort of like a comment on the actual like overpopulation of the earth. And it's one of the main things is that because the earth is overpopulated, a disease comes along and wipes it down to almost nothing. But then the same thing happens to the ants. Suddenly the ants are roving too much, and suddenly one day, no ants. And it's just
there's a law that kills crowded fat species. You know,
I'm not sure if that is a law, but it's interesting that he says that's one of the laws.
He's extrapolating from real science, real world
I'm just
stuff,
wondering,
and then I would say he's guessing a lot as to what is going on rather than projecting, right? The way he guesses is very effective, because some of it seems logically explained and others are left mysterious, and that's how the world really is, right? Is a lot of it's easily understood and a lot of it's not.
Yeah. I'm just saying that sometimes I wasn't quite sure if it was the author. George R. Stewart. Have we even mentioned that George R. Stewart is the author of Earth Abides? Have we even mentioned that? Sometimes I wasn't quite sure if it was the author saying, this is the overpopulation, or if it was actually the main character, because I just think the character voice I was forgetting this was actually written in third person, because it feels just so much, like you say, you're so close into his head. That sometimes I wasn't quite sure if it was the author saying this because the author knew it, or like you say, the character saying it because the character knowing it. And I wasn't sure if about the ants.
I think they were supposed to be interchangeable. I mean,
yes, you know. And it feels like
I mean, he's an ecologist, and it's pretty clear to me that if George R. Stewart was not personally an ecologist, he studied enough to become very familiar with the subject.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. There were some things that bothered me about it. The main thing that bothered me about it was that there's no will to power. There's only a will to live. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it didn't show up in the book. I don't think there was, except for the character of Charlie, right? And his was not necessarily that. It was just he wants what he wants, and what he wants he'll take. Mm-hmm.
I think that like Spinoza and Schopenhauer and those guys, they said that the central thing was their survival instinct, and that's one side of the coin. And then Nietzsche came along and he said, you know, perseverance in a static world, is not enough to explain human activity. And so he created this thing called will to power, because the world is constantly in flux, and we try to impose order on it through activity and mastery, action and control, that sort of thing. And that's the central motivating force for human energies and the source of creativity. Mm-hmm. And I tend to believe that, but the book leaned more towards the Spinoza-Schopenhauer thing, because everybody was lazy. They wanted to survive, but, you know, I can't believe how long it took the guy to get to the library.
Yeah, just to go back a bit over the story, I guess, because what happens, he's one of the only people left alive, and then he, after a tour around the country, he settles down in his own home. I mean, he doesn't even find a better place to live. He just goes, oh, well, where my parents, I've always lived here. My parents lived in this home. And he just goes back to San Francisco, and he just sets up in his own home. And then he, you know, and then he sets up his new society in his own home. It's not, it's like, yeah, because we can just go and get the tins from the shops, and we don't even have to worry about farming. We don't have to worry about this. And I just found that amazing that he was like, you know, he went across the whole country to find other people. And then in the end, he was just like, just go home. I let you say is that home, just, and he was just like, yeah, but I'll be okay here.
But I think that was also the trend of all the characters in the book, right? Everyone was going home, and it's just it took him a little longer than the other people.
I can see that. Yeah,
but I'm just saying it's that sort of like just the will to survive or just get along and be lazy, almost be lazy about it. You know, there are other groups of people that are mentioned in the book who are actually doing more stuff, and these people are farming. These people have horses, and
these people have a wacko religion.
Right. But you know, like. You remember when he first shoots the cow, and he cuts out its liver and goes home and eats it? I mean, I can't believe the guy didn't. I mean, the first thing I would do is go to the library and get a book on how to render game. You know what I mean? Like, he can't fix a battery. He can't. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that just blew me away. I mean, the very first thing I would do is go and
lots of library love in this book. In fact, there's probably more library love in this book than almost any other book I've read, but.
Well, I'm not so sure, because if you read, like you say, if you read Lucifer's Hammer, there's this whole character, there's a scientist character who has all these books on how things work and does this, and he wraps every single volume up in a bit of plastic, in a plastic bag, and puts in some mothballs, and then wraps them up and then stores them all in a, in a septic tank that's like deep under, like under his back garden, which is, you know, and he puts it in there and he's going to keep it all in there. So he's actually saving the knowledge because he knows it's going to be very important for all the people afterwards. And again, it's just that I thought it was amazing with Isherwood. Like, he's obviously like got his head screwed on in some ways, but he just goes, oh, well, I'll just hammer this bit of wood over the doorway to the library. And that's it. I mean, there's nothing else that he...
Yeah. Well, he has sort of an ambivalent relationship with it, right? I mean, we get that feeling that he's not doing enough. We get that feeling that he's not doing enough, but he also is very respectful of it. But in the end, he thinks, you know, after a certain point in the novel, he sort of gives up and he says, you know, we're not going to be the people that we were. And if we're going to be those people, it's not going to be in my lifetime.
Right. I think that it's a function of the 1947 when it was written, because the characters had to be ignorant out of laziness. Whereas, because in 1947, I mean, you could understand technology without any special tools. I mean, you understand a carburetor a lot better than you understand a fuel injector. Mm-hmm. So you could have, if you said it today, those people could have the skills but not the access to the gear to actually fix the fuel injector, and that would change who they were. The thing that bugged
that would
me
be
about
it interesting. That, yeah, it just I never thought of it that way. What if the setting was moved up to the present, it would be very different.
Well, right. He has to have this device in the plot that makes the people lazy and ignorant. And because he's trying to get to a point, and I agree with his point once he actually gets there. I just wish that, you know, in 1947, he would have been able to figure out some way to keep the characters from being ignorant out of laziness.
Well, I found that one of the most resonant parts of the book, and in the sense that there are a lot of people we send to university these days, but that we're sending them there because it's a socially appropriate thing to do, not because they have an actual aptitude and a love of learning. And I mean, just look at the majority of the production of anything, and you can see the mediocre is very well loved, and that the depression he gets in the novel is kind of like the feeling I have when I talk to a lot of people. It's just, you're not gonna be able to have a conversation about much other than the weather, because they haven't read a book since they were in university, and they didn't like it when they did that there.
And why is dumb so cool?
Because I think it doesn't require any thinking. It doesn't.
But why is that cool?
It doesn't require it. You know, the thing is if you're an intellectual person, you wouldn't even ask that question. A non-intellectual person, you wouldn't even ask that question.
That is such a good point. That's very clever. Like, if you're going to be... The only people who are intelligent enough to question the coolness of lack of intelligence know, even conceive that it is cool.
And
or notice that it shouldn't be cool and it is or something. Yes, it's a bit strange.
Yep, and we don't have as many kids. And so we get more and more outnumbered.
Well, yeah, that's the theory. That's the theory that
I don't agree with.
I'm not sure. I think it can be spontaneously arisen. I'm not sure that genius begets genius, because I know there's a lot of geniuses who haven't produced.
True.
You know, and it may be that it's not particularly related to genetics, and I see stupid kids coming out of intelligent people and intelligent people coming out of stupid. So
I think when you get back and do the big statistical numbers, though, there's going to be a gene pool influence that says, you know, two smart people get together and they have a kid with a slightly higher IQ. I believe there's a nature nurture aspect to the thing. But I think if you're talking about the billions of people walking around on this planet, if you match them up, you could make the race smarter. You could make it taller. You could make it smaller. You could do whatever
you
want.
Well, I think taller you can probably make a pretty good case for easily. But I'm not sure that intelligence is keyed that way, and especially not in the kind we're talking about, because it may be that it's just a particular interest, right? Some people take an interest in some things, and other people take an interest in another thing. And one thing that people take an interest in is thinking, right? It's an activity that they enjoy, and they practice it. It's what they do. It's all like I don't think of myself as a particularly genius style person, but I know I'm bloody intelligent because I've read so many goddamn books. I know a lot more than the people around me, and that's just a fact. But I don't think, you know, it's because of superior brain power. I think it might be superior interest.
So you don't have any sort of innate property in you? It's entirely nurture?
No, obviously, you know, if I had some sort of defect, we've got one character in the story who's got a sort of an unknown defect, right? What's her name? I was going to say Emmy, but I'm not.
Oh,
it's Evie.
Evie. Okay, Evie. Evie. Yeah. Emmy's the wife, right?
M.
What's that short for?
Emma.
Okay. Shows you not always the brightest light in the room, but the fact that she we don't know what happens to her, and he sort of plays the, you know, we can't let her breed because we've got so few people. It'll dumb down the race is sort of what I guess was that you were saying, Greg?
Well, yeah, in reverse, yeah, absolutely. You certainly agreed with that, right? I mean, not that Evie should or shouldn't be able to breed, but that
if
the possibility of a child coming out of Evie being
it would depend on what the nature of her defect is. If her defect is, you know, from a brain lesion. That's not likely to be reproduced. And the thing is
They even say that in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, because we don't know what she was prior to the thing, and the thing may have been what made her learning disabled.
I don't think she had any particular look to her other than vacancy, right?
Right. I'm not trying to argue for eugenics here. I'm just saying I think that if you took
statistically,
you would the curve of IQ would go up if you put smart people together and made them have kids.
It would seem to make sense, but the problem is finding that test, right? So the IQ test is the standard one, but anyone who I know who's taken the IQ test and scored high on it, I haven't. It's not commonly taken in North America. This area, anyways, Canada.
Right.
It's it's not about necessarily the ability to ask questions that are deep. It's about your ability to take a test on something that's particularly constructed for test. I mean, it's just like polling, right? It's all about the question. It's not about what the answers is, because the questions form the answers.
Exactly. Which is, to me, I mean, this all goes back to basic physics for me, the observer's position in the universe. So you can't put together a survey that isn't biased. You can't create a test that isn't biased. You can't theoretically, understand the psychology of another human being, for that matter, because you yourself are one, and what you see is affected by who you are.
I sometimes think I want to make one of those, memes that people send out to each other by email, and the one that, I would just assemble a list of questions that, like, do you think what the government did to Alan Turing was wrong? And the only thing I want to have is a sort of a sentence that follows that, and that they hopefully didn't use Google to find the answer, right? If they know right. the answer to that question, and they said anything other than, I don't know, no. If they said no, then I think it's
good, because the Apple logo is meant to, I've heard the Apple logo is meant to be a reference to it. So, and I think it's a really cool Apple logo.
I think I looked it up on Snopes, and it's not.
Oh, is it right? Okay. No, I'm just saying that just to prove that I know who he is and what they did and what the consequences are.
It's not a test of intelligence, even. I'm sure there are lots of intelligent
right.
people.
It's more of a
test of whether I want you to be. I knew I wanted to be friends with Greg Marguerite. I knew I wanted to be friends with him because he kept recording stuff that I said, oh man, this is good, right? And he kept picking things that were interesting for his recordings on LibriVox. So I said, oh, this is a guy I would like. Because a lot of other people, they sort of just pick random things, it seems like. Or they just, I don't know, they're picking their interests. But I knew.
Don't get me started.
I knew, oh God, this guy's got to be my friend. I got to find him and try and cajole him into being my friend, because then we could talk. And
here we are.
Here we are. Let's get back on this book, though. I mean, on this.
Should we?
But I think.
I know. It's a wide range, because I think this is the kind of book which it's got so much in here that we could probably talk about like all these tiny little parts. I mean, I couldn't even make notes as I was going through this book, because I was so into it. I was so absorbed in it, and I was so taken up with the writing and the issues and the topics and the themes that it kept on bringing up. Just like every, I mean, I was listening to it as an audiobook, but every few minutes, the main character Ish had sort of changed his mind about something and gone in a different direction, and then changed his mind, it's not always changing his mind, but always had a new realization and stepping from this bit to this bit. So,
yep.
As a continuation of the story, he sets up a little, not like a commune, because I guess a commune is where you shut off the rest of the world, and the rest of the world is dead. So it's not a commune, it's like
a
little
continuation. He calls it a tribe.
Well, they call themselves a tribe.
Yeah, they eventually call themselves a tribe as a joke, and it sticks, right?
Yeah. And it's just him, a woman he finds, and then some other people who come along, and they start having kids. And yes, we don't need to go too much into it, but it's really, the story is, after the setup, is really about the establishment of this little tribe with Ish as the figurehead, even though he's not really a born leader, but he's the only one who's got the college education. I mean, he was halfway through his college education, I guess,
when he was in graduate school.
Yeah.
Oh, graduate school, wasn't it? Yeah. But I knew he was still a student, but and he's there doing his thing and trying to keep people. And so, of course, the kids, he's trying to teach them to read. And, of course, they don't need to read, because, they don't. I mean, why do they need to read? It's a lot of stuff going on there with that. But really, that's the story, and about the different dynamics and the different people who come and go. And I don't think we need to go too much into the details.
No,
but there's lots
let's assume that everybody who's listening has read the book or is going to read the book as soon as they start listening. Because,
But I'd also like to say one more thing. If you're this, no matter how much we talk about here tonight,
true.
It will not do this book justice.
True.
This is so well written.
If we just sit down and read it for yourself, read the rest of the book for the whole podcast, then it would be enough. But it's not. You're going to have to sit down.
I'm just saying that I think it'd be a bit pity to say who survives until the end, or you know, and that kind of stuff, because there are some real emotional impacts when some people, yes, who you hope are going to get through maybe don't, and other people who, you know, it's a bit strange, and I wouldn't want to give that too much of that stuff away. But we can talk about all the rest of it, like I say, without spoiling some of the processes there. So one thing that I'm really impressed with in this book is the talking about sort of like the, I'm not sure if he had, because this is quite soon after the Second World War, isn't it? Let me look.
Yeah, 47. Yep.
1947.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So when I was reading this, I was thinking, does he know about the cargo cults? And is it too soon for him to know about the cargo cults after the Second World War? And if people don't know about the cargo cults, that's when, you know, people...
That's going to be another question on my list.
A Coke bottle in the...
Yeah. Would you ever be a member of a cargo cult? That would be...
That's a good one. That's a good one. There were cargo cults in the 19th century that I know of. So
yeah, but the ones that you really know about is these South Pacific islands, which the United States went and they set up airfields on them. And it's actually quite an interesting topic, because most people think, these people are stupid, but a lot of them actually had some kind of messiah figure who came along.
They're still going, though. That's the amazing thing.
Yeah,
right?
No,
even with modern contact, there are still people who are maintaining the faith.
However, it's actually if you read about if you find out about the beginnings of these cults, they actually had a figure who said, if you follow me, the gods will come down and defeat our enemies and supply you with, you know, with this stuff, and there'll be this miracles. And then they did follow him, and then the United States Navy or whoever it was did turn up. So there is actually
that's like the Montezuma and Quetzalcoatl story, right?
Yeah,
in a way.
Have either of you seen the Gods Must Be Crazy?
Yeah, no. Nope. That's similar.
Yeah, it's an Australian movie about an isolated Aboriginal group, and a Coke bottle falls out of a plane, and it completely remakes their society. The various uses they have for the Coke bottle. It's that kind of approach to things. So
yeah, I guess that could be the same kind of thing as this. But I'm just saying that this is a really nice view on the creation of a religion, but a creation of superstition. And this is something which Isherwood, the main character, is really dead against. However, nothing he can do can stop it. You know, all his best intentions about not setting up a new superstition and not being this sort of godlike figure who knows everything and knows science and is like a wizard, you know, of the day. And it's really strange how it doesn't matter how rational you are about something, you will attach irrationality to things. Well, not irrationality to things. You will. And I find it so amazing that by the end of the book, he's actually saying, oh, and that's because I'm a god. And then he's like, no, I'm not a god.
Those are good lines.
It's because I'm a messenger from a god. And
just, I think it was
it was very important that, you know how they keep pinching him? They pinch their god to make him wake up and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's an old Jewish proverb. I think it's, if God lived on earth, people would break his windows.
Yeah.
And so it's that kind. I mean, I think it was very important for him to set up on one side that he was being turned into a god, but on the other hand, he let those people pinch him, which brought him back to earth again, turned him back into a human being.
There's a sociological phenomenon in small tribal groups as well, where people who live in a small community who have a traditional leader, you know, a tribal leader, a chief of some kind. The chief's role is not ceremonial necessarily, but it is full of ribbing, right? It is it's almost like a fop, because he has no guns to match, you know, his position, right? But everyone recognizes that, yeah, he's the leader, but, you know, he's just another guy, and he can be poked fun at, right?
Yeah, and that's what I was getting at, is that, you know, they could actually petition their Lord with prayer. They could pinch him.
Yep. And they demanded an answer.
It's probably the most interesting book about pinching I've ever read. Maybe the only book that has a lot of pinching in it. And it was almost, you know, it's almost heartwarming.
Yeah. Well, what's heartwarming? Go ahead.
No, carry on. Because I was going to go somewhere else.
What's heartwarming is that, yes, he has to face the taboo and the religion, the witchcraft, the shamanism, the totems, all that sort of stuff. But towards the end of the book, he learns how to play it.
Yeah, he embraces
it. Uses it to his advantage. And he actually essentially saves humanity by doing that.
Sure.
By giving them the tools. I don't want to do a spoiler, but...
Yeah, but he does help out in a way that you wouldn't expect in the end, you know, because he's all like, oh, it's got to be reading, you got to be learn to read, and you got to be intelligent, and you got to be educated, and stuff like that. And actually, he comes to realize that that's not the only way it can be. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, he has to let go of the past. And the whole thing leads towards his letting go on the last page of the book. And I won't say what happens, but... you know, he lets go once and for all and realizes that it was okay. You know, essentially, he puts the loss in perspective, in context, and is okay with
the
results.
You are almost okay with it, too, right? At the end of the book, you're followed his journey. You know, no, we can't lose these. These are our most precious resources, and yet nobody cares. And so what can we do? And he's despondent, but... he comes to accept it, and you're almost like, yeah, so the library's going to, you know, molder away and burn down. And
yep.
The thing is, what does it really matter if humanity's dead, right? If you read the story, The Star, Arthur C. Clarke's story, The Star, right?
Sure.
The humans come and discover this ancient civilization that died 3,000 years ago. And they've left all their wonderful works of art, and we're there to appreciate it. At least that's the good takeaway from the huge negative, which is they died because Jesus needed to be born, right? There's a spoiler for you. Okay.
I think that cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, probably. Well, this one is too, I think. But the thing is it. You can rationally accept something, but it's much easier to emotionally accept something. And I've been talking with Scott about, you know, why books have to be so goddamn long. Well, this one was appropriately long because it's making an intellectual argument as well as an emotional argument. The intellectual argument is basically about the Earth, I think, and the emotional argument is about how we should feel in reaction to things that happen. And I was moved by it. I was moved intellectually and emotionally by it.
Yeah, I agree. I actually thought about tearing up once or twice, and again, I won't spoil anything, but he hooked me.
No, I'm definitely there, and that's very, very rarely that a book can sort of hit me at that level as well. I mean, I can't even remember the last time. It happens quite a bit in movies. It happens with music as well. I can listen to music and tear up. I mean, there's even a few times at this juggling convention that I went to in Finland, and someone did something on stage, and it was more, one of them was very much a dance thing, but another one was a juggling thing, and I can get it. But when reading, especially actually listening to an audiobook, it's very, very rare that it can actually affect me, so I can sort of feel that lump in my stomach.
I wasn't quite there. I can totally see it.
But there was these times, and I do, just to say that the what's the name of the narrator of this?
Jonathan Davis.
Right. Jonathan Davis, who did the amazing narrator. I've only heard him do the Pablo Bacigalupi, the wind-up girl. He did that, and also the Alchemist from The Alchemist and the Executionist, which is the bit that he did with Tobias S. Bacal. Pablo Bacigalupi said that, did that one. And And this is a little bit brisker, because in that he's sort of very, it's very literary, and he talks quite slowly with lots of pauses like that. Well, but this is, carry on, Greg.
I was just going to say that's, when I go back to the calm exposition of this thing, he was great at that.
It's just amazing.
He could take your flesh crawl.
Yeah, definitely one of the best narrations that I've heard. And I know I am sort of like, I've only heard another two of his narrations before this, but it is sort of like a step up from the other ones that I've heard.
Yeah, he's done a lot. He did all the Mike Resnick Starship books, and he's done a ton of Star Wars. But, he's at his A game. He's got the great material. And this is, I can't say a bad word about this audiobook other than Connie Willis is not a great reader. What she read was great. Her introduction.
I didn't listen to the introduction, actually. I always skip over introductions.
Definitely go back and listen to it again.
Yeah, it's worth it.
It's worth it. Yeah. You know, she hypes up the book and she says you're going to...
Her voice annoys me so much.
Yeah, she's not got a great reading voice. And it sounds like she's reading it rather than performing it. But I don't care because it's a good introduction. That's basically the only quibble I could have with this production is that... You know, her voice personally didn't add that much to what is an excellent essay about introducing the book. And it's definitely go back and listen to that.
Okay. Well, I always hate introductions before the book begins. I just started listening to, I'm about 5 hours into a book by, I probably have it here. Let me bring it up. It's called Deep Six by Jack McDevitt. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, he's like, oh, this is what I want to do in an audiobook. I want to get a character and put them in this situation and then do this. And so in this book, it talks about, and I was just like, wait a second, you just spoiled it. And I'm still now waiting to get up to the point where we run off the end of the story, which he manages to spoil within 15 seconds of the introduction.
There is a danger there.
I'm really disappointed because this book, I mean, the adventure that they're going on is really interesting. I don't want to spoil what he said, but seriously, if you read it, skip over the introduction. Always skip over the introduction because I don't think they do it in books so much, but certainly for an audiobook, it's like hey, I'm the author.
Technical issue. I mean, it could have been an afterword and...
Yeah, maybe an afterword. Yeah. I just couldn't believe it. And as soon as he said that, and I was like, wait a second, this is the book that I'm reading now. I mean, if it was like, oh, this is what happened in the previous book, and now let me explain what's going on. I mean, I guess I'll go more into that in my review of Deep Six. But I was just really disappointed because even now, like 5 hours in, I pretty much know. I always knew what was going to happen or what the crisis is going to be. Some books, it doesn't. You know, that already. Like in this book, I knew it was going to be post-apocalyptic, but.
Right.
Again,
it's funny because when I read a book, I don't read the intro until after I'm done with the book. But when I listen to a book,
with an audio book,
I listen to it in the order it's presented to me. You know, it's funny.
Tricky, and I don't normally do that.
Yeah,
but for some reason it caught me out.
So maybe skip ahead. I don't think it's particularly spoilerish in this. I did listen to it, and it does. Give some hints as to the details, and I think it probably would have been better as an afterword, like where Isherwood's name came from. I mean, I didn't obviously make that connection instantaneously, but it did.
Oh, where does it come from?
Ishmael from Moby Dick, and okay, forget I said that. Scott, cut this out.
No, it's okay.
We don't do cuts. So it'll be fine.
Okay.
Actually, to be honest, if I'd have thought about it for a minute or two, I could probably work that out.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it depends on how... I mean, I think Greg would know because he's an American and it's an American story, but...
No, I mean, but how many other Isherwoods are there?
No, it's not actually...
No, it's the fake. Ish.
Yeah, it's the Ish.
Right. Yeah, but it's the Ish as well. But yeah, I guess that's the yeah, because I kept on forgetting his name, and it's really funny that later on he sees his name again, doesn't he? And it's been so long, and he's forgotten his own name. He's like, "Who's this Isherwood guy?"
Yeah.
The thing is, the same thing. I had the same thing in the way that when he actually worked out, he would sort of put in reminders of what his name was, and that he's not thought of himself as that person for such a long time. You know?
Yeah.
What do you? Let's skip around a little bit. Okay. One of the characters I really, really liked, even though we don't get a lot of him, and we get him sort of through dim eyes, I guess, is the great-grandson, Jack.
Yep.
I loved his name. I wonder how he, how he got that name. I don't think it was mentioned,
No.
But it seems like It was like, obviously, it was planned, right? We got to assume that he planned to name him that. But I thought that character came out really well. And he sort of brought the culture that, you know, that those younger people had through those dull eyes. And I was very impressed. I mean, I'm not a character-based, I don't read for characters, but I thought that was a really good, I mean, Isherwood's a fine character, but he's sort of us, right? He's our viewpoint character. He's the intellectual man. So we don't bond with him the way we would bond with another sort of different kind of person. And
Maybe.
I think.
You know, if this were the 40s, I'd cast Spencer Tracy to play the role. He's more of a regular guy.
You mean of Isherwood?
Yeah.
He thinks he's an intellectual. I mean, he sets himself up as like, oh yeah, I'm the graduate student, and if this disaster hadn't happened, I'd be a professor in the university. He wouldn't be a professor in the university. He would go on to do something. He'd be an administrator or maybe a researcher or maybe.
You think he's not quite up to snuff?
No, there's no way. I mean, he thinks he is the intellectual in this area, and he thinks about this, and, you know, his opinion of himself as a great intellectual.
Yeah, he sort of does have a little blind spot, doesn't he?
Yeah, compared to the people around him, of course it is, because a lot of the other people around him aren't simple, but they're just not intellectual in the same way. So he's now, of course, later on when he's going, oh, yes, and if it hadn't been this, and he goes to his library and says, oh, yes, I could have been a professor here, and, you know, and at this point people would be looking up to me as this haloed old professor. And I'm like, no, they wouldn't. You know, you're telling yourself that, but there's no way he was that. So I think, you're right, he is very much more of an everyman, but just who happens to be dropped into a situation where he is more of the intellectual.
Yeah. You know, and if
that's just my opinion of him. I just saw him having a little, like you say, maybe a slightly higher opinion of himself.
He does have, he's very healthy telling. Opinion of himself.
Yeah, I think that I would have, it's very important. The first time he goes to the library, he takes out, Robinson Crusoe and the Swiss Family Robinson and all this stuff. I mean, I would have taken out electromechanical engineering and figured out how to keep the generators running, you know. And,
exactly.
And I didn't think a lot about generators, did he?
No, and that's what I think that's what Luke was getting at. He isn't.
If he was the intellectual, he wouldn't have gone, oh, the water's failed. Oh, let's dig a well. He wouldn't do that. He'd go. He'd be going along and checking the pipes. It's like going, okay, we're relying on this water. Where the hell does this water come from?
Yeah,
right,
but
let's
I
track
think the
down
reason he's not like that. I mean, I think the reason he's not like that is because that's not what the book is really. The message of the book is not that, right?
Joey, is more like that than he is.
Yes. He's much
and he sees that in Joey, of course, but it's sort of like when Joey, when they're just a mild spoiler here, is that they go and try to find a truck because they want to go on a longer trip. So they want to find a truck, but it's been 22 years. And really, of course, Isherwood does work it out and tries to get the battery working and stuff like that. But it's his son, Joey, who's the one who goes, oh, we could just do it this way. And he's like, oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. And it's like you realize that actually he is being outthought by lots of other people. And also his wife,
he is surprised by people.
Yeah, and his wife, Em, as well. And he's all like, oh, yeah, this and this. But she's the, she's the one holding things together. Yeah, and Ezra, he's a good friend, but, you know, who understands people. You know, that's the whole thing, isn't it? He says, Ezra, he knew people and he liked people and people liked him and it was easy to get on with and stuff like that. And, of course, it's a different kind of intelligence from Joey, a different kind of intelligence from Emma and Em and Ezra and these other people. And also the character called Charlie as well. There's another whole thing there. And in every single one of these people, Isherwood... he meets his match in every single one of them.
Yes, including George, the plumber.
Yeah, as well.
Yeah. Carpenter.
But he also does. He
Carpenter.
Does the plumbing
job.
Yeah. As well.
Sorry.
He's always fixing houses, but I don't think he does any. None of the plumbing works, right? I think maybe they start.
No. It does.
They did a well.
20 years.
I think.
Yeah.
It Yeah, it works for a long time, but they do say that George is the one who helps with the plumbing too. But yeah, I mean, like I'm saying, everything, every person, every other like of these main characters that you meet, even his dog at the beginning,
yeah,
it's like it's shown quite blatantly that the dog is using Ish. What was the name of the dog? I can't remember what it was.
Princess,
that was it. Yeah, so all the way through, or all the time that the dog stays with him, you understand that he's playing almost second to the dog all the time, you know. Of course, the dog helps him and he helps the dog, but really you understand that relationship, that like he thinks he's in control and he thinks he's the master, but he even says, oh no, she found me and she's adopted me as a master rather than, no, she's adopted me as... or as her pet, or whatever it is, you know. But we get that, and that same relationship is reflected by every single one of these other relationships.
Yes.
That you realize actually, him by himself would be completely out of his depth. He's too intellectual in some ways, but not intellectual enough in the other ways. And all of these other people complete him as a person. That's what I find really interesting.
Exactly what we were talking about before. As you know, I say I make this friends list. Right, or a friends quiz, and the thing is this book is arguing against that. Right, it's saying that are not just you know, it's not just about what you know or what you read. It's also about, you know, the whole human species isn't about, you know, just intellectual activity. And I think this book makes a very powerful emotional and kind of rational argument for it. And that's why it was so changing for me is I think, yeah, well, no, I'm riding high on my intellectual superiority, my grasp of things because I've actually read something, right? I know a little about what's going on. I care about what's going on, so I pay attention. That might not be everything, Jesse. Oh, shit. Really? Okay.
Yeah, it's a great line in one of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy things where they say, oh, and all these three spaceships went and they put all the intellectual people on one spaceship and they put all the workers on the other spaceship and they put all the people who do the annoying jobs that nobody knows what the job is really there for, like telephone sanitization, things like that.
Yep.
And the telephone sanitization and all that class of jobs, that crashed on the way. And everyone's like, oh, it doesn't matter, we don't need these people anyway. And then they all died 2 years later from an infection that they caught from a septic telephone. You know, it's one of those things that you actually go, actually, society is all the different bits and humanity is all the different bits. And you can't just go, oh, well, we'll just have the intellectual people. Oh, it'll be working now. Because you realize that if you have all the people who think that they're intellectual, you realize actually that's not the best set.
Right. And Adams shows you the other side of that coin, though, because if you remember the pointless workers, they adopt leaves as a currency and the economy collapses and they all die.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true as well. That was a different side of it, wasn't it? Yeah. There are the different sides of it, but I'm just saying that, it was the intellectuals who died out because the telephone sanitizer kind of people didn't. They weren't there to their jobs.
If you're talking about the Hitchhiker's Guide series, I just had an insight there. Maybe the whole series is best treated as like a canon, a religious canon, like the Bible. It's not best read, you know, by sitting down and going all the way through, start to finish.
Yeah,
it's better to talk about particular scenes and particular, you know. The electric monk is, you know, a scene that will stand out well in my mind. I don't know what book it's in, but I know that scene. And I think that's not even Hitchhiker's Guide. I think that's a different Douglas Adams.
Yeah, I think so.
But
there are lots of things like that in the Hitchhiker's
Guide.
The dish of the day.
Yeah.
In my review of the Hitchhiker's Guide for my podcast, I say that the introduction of the book within the book of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it's literally someone just said, oh, we'll just put together this, and it's a collection of lots of different bits and pieces, and it's not, you know, the Encyclopedia Galactica, or whatever they call it. It is that, and it's a collection of scenes, and it's a collection of information, it's a collection of stories. That is what the novel is as well. It's just a collection of scenes, it's a collection of stories, it's a collection of characters, and that's what those books are. So that's why you can go in and you can just pick out a scene, or pick out a character, or pick out a thing, because it is what the description of the book within the book is as well, is what the book is.
A good point.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you think, I mean, he started out as a script editor for Doctor Who during the Tom Baker years. So if you think about the way those books are constructed, they're constructed roughly along the same way that era was put together.
You know,
an incredibly amusing ramification of some stupid thing that happened. Mm-hmm. And then you play out the various sides on that. And yeah, I think there's actually a lot of really tough choices. I brought up Dish of the Day, but, you know, I mean, would you rather have an animal that doesn't want to be eaten but can't tell you, or an animal that does want to be eaten and can tell
you?
Well,
asking that question, right, you're facing the reality. I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that the question's important.
Yeah, for me, if I'm hungry, I eat.
Yeah.
Well, the good thing about genetic engineering that way is the beast would say, please have more.
Yeah.
My ribs are particularly succulent.
But I think it doesn't Arthur then say, I'll just have a salad? Yeah. And he says, I'll send him right out. I'm sure I'll want to talk to you, sir.
Right.
So, yeah. Anyway, okay, back to
Earth.
Yeah,
can we pick up on some other themes on this? Just a quick thing about as another compare and contrast with Lucifer's Hammer, which I'm guessing you guys might have read before. One of the things that I mentioned in my review of that was that it was I'm not saying that the book was racist, but the view on it now, it just seemed a bit weird that the forces of good were always represented by white guys, intelligent, rich white guys, and then the forces of darkness was all the black people and stuff like that, which I thought was a bit strange. And there was a very, you know, actually someone emailed me and says, oh no, there's this character who's good, but the black character who's good also happens to be an astronaut and is actually held up as a token black man, as the token good black man, the token like credible and successful black man who goes to space and comes back again and is, oh yes, this black man's right, but all the rest of the dark is about, you know, it was a bit weird. However, in this, I think it's a bit interesting because it's set and was written way before Lucifer's Hammer. And even though it says, oh, this was a Negro group and there was this Negro family that survived, the one of the main characters, M, is black, but we actually don't notice that until quite a long time.
Wait a minute.
What's the story there?
Two competing references. At one point, she says she's talking about Africa and says, my people.
Mm-hmm.
And at another point, she's talking about Native Americans and referring to herself in the first person again. So I was, at first I said, oh, she's black. That was cool for 1947. And then, like, you know, 100
I'm saying
pages
that,
later,
that they
she
meet.
Was Native American.
Really Native American?
I have to go back.
I think you've misread
Shall
maybe
I read
misread
the
it?
Wikipedia entry?
No.
Where
okay.
they've argued no. for previously. Okay, so there are citations here, so people have argued about this. Emma is a woman who Isherwood meets in his hometown. The author may have been talking about a chance encounter who is African-American while Isherwood is white. When the book was written, interracial marriages were heavily discouraged in American society. Isherwood does marry her, and race isn't important to the couple's relationship, rather that they become partners in the marriage and the community. Now, it's got a citation. But it's someone else's website, so we won't go in there. So it says she's African American, but let's talk. Well, one of the things.
No, let me. I think
you're making
important.
a good point, and like when you were talking about in your review of.
No.
Oh, sorry. Continue.
I want to come back to this point when he says she's a Native American. I never picked up on that as in
I don't.
You know,
I think it's a modern term, right?
Indian. Yeah, but the way that I picked up, because one of the main themes of this book is that Ish becomes the last American. He calls himself that at the end.
But he's the last living one, right?
He's the last living one. But when I heard that that M was a Native American, I didn't. I remember the reference that you're saying now, but I never picked up that she was like American Indian.
Right.
Native
I'm not
American.
Even sure if Native American was a
no, I don't
a
think
term
it's a term then.
Exactly. So right. when they said Native American, now I remember what you're saying, but I never thought of that. I picked it up as in she was natively American. She had she was born American.
Right. She was an American national.
That's more the kind of thing. And I think that's an important thing because I definitely picked up that she was either, you know, African American or, you know, black, as we would say, or I guess if you're a black American, you're African American, or some kind of mix and things like that. But they meet first of all, and then it's only after a while that Isherwood is like, oh yeah, you're black. You know, and it seems to be that kind of thing. Well, it doesn't matter. You know, and then they just pick it up.
It's just a knockoff. It's just a reference that she makes when they're talking about how well it worked for her people, and she happens to be referring to Africa. Mm-hmm. She doesn't ever say no one says anything. I mean, I loved it when I first heard it. I'm like, this is great for 1947, mm-hmm. you know. But
yeah, so that's what I'm picking up. So I wanted to clarify that I don't think she's Native American. I think that if he does say Native and American, he's saying, you know, natively American culturally and mindset wise and stuff.
Okay.
Anyway,
I'll take it back.
Sorry, Jesse, go back and talk about Lucifer.
Well, I was just, when I was listening to your review of it, I was thinking, you know, I think Luke's right. I think there is that stuff in there. I mean, it is kind of strange, but I'm not to me, people who are racist are people who talk about race. If you talk about race all the time, it must be because it's in your mind and you're thinking about it a lot, right? Why are you thinking about it a lot? Well, because it's something that either you're living with or something that you're dealing with, right? And the thing is race doesn't exist. It's a sociological idea. There are what we call classifications, you know, skin color classifications, but the race test is bullshit. It's not science. It's something, but it's not science. And so when we talk about, you know, lumping things into little boxes or, you know, sorting things into boxes, it always rings true to me as false, right? So I would think, why is Larry Niven talking about this? Why is Jerry Purnell talking about this? Well, it might be social level, right? If you are low social level, maybe you're more prone to violence. I don't know. I don't know what the stats are on that. What I do know is that it's a big deal in the U.S. It's a big deal. I don't know why. Yes, I don't know why it is such a big deal. Other than I know the history, but I don't live the history. You know,
I can answer that.
Okay,
for you. It's that the people that you think of thinking of race all the time, mm-hmm. they need to have somebody who's below them on the ladder, mm-hmm. and barring that, they're the bottom rung, and they can't live with it, and so they turn on Fox News.
I'm not sure that's the only people who watch Fox News. My understanding is that a lot of the people,
it's a wider audience.
No, a lot of the people are doing it for ideological reasons, right? It's part of their religion. So one of the things that Scott told me that we didn't mention in a podcast, I don't know when he mentioned it to me, but I thought, wow, that really is insightful, right? So the thing he told me that was just blew my mind is, you know, why is Glenn Beck the way he is? Well, it's sort of, you know, half this and half that, but half educated because he's read some books and half crazy because of some other thing. Well, here's the key insight, right? The key insight is he's a Mormon, and Mormons of his particular ilk believed that the Constitution of the United States was divinely inspired. That is, the Mormon religion is derived in part from the Constitution of the United States. And so he has a personal relationship and a personal stake in understanding his country is part of his ideology. And I said, whoa, I can't imagine. Like if I was a religious person and I thought, oh, you know, this piece of paper written by a bunch of dead white guys or dead whatever guys or dead whatever women is really important to me, and it's part of my, you know, it's part of your everyday, I don't know, legal system. It's what you're thinking about all the time.
Yeah.
Then, of course, you're going to be a little bit more wacko. Just like I always say, you know, the reason Orson Scott Card hates gays is not because he's met lots of gays and he hates them, because they're always coming on to him or whatever. It's because it's part of his ideology. It's part of his belief system. And we're kind of getting off topic. We're talking about why Fox News works. But I think, you know, this book is a lot about religion, and yet it's very innocuous. Like, I think the way, you know, we're sort of dissing Isherwood's his intellect, but he has the right attitude anyways. He has a very skeptical attitude. And I like what the author, I guess George R. Stewart, does with, you know, the various characters and their various belief systems, how they come to respond and how that works out in the later, you know, the superstition. When you guys were talking about that earlier, I was thinking, you know, we still pick up the newspaper today, and it's got, you know, the comics section and the weather section and the astrology section. And every time I see that part of the page, I go, oh, right, there's a whole bunch of idiots who actually get this paper every day and read it and I don't know, take it in something.
You know what? That's an excellent example of what we're talking about here. Is the universe a synchronous object? Well, probably. Can you, by looking at the objects in the universe, predict the future? Well, there's too many variables. So, you know, the pattern is there. Astrology, I mean, if you have a synchronistic view of the universe, then it would make sense that you can look at the things around you and figure out what's going to happen tomorrow. But can you gather that information by making a bunch of charts and looking at stars and who's in retrograde and all that? That's just not enough data to do it. So I think the fundamental idea, if we could have all of the information in the universe, we could tell the future.
That's absolutely true, but that's not what's going on, right?
No, but again,
assuming that the observations don't affect the outcome, right? Assuming that's true, then yes.
But I think that Fox News is a machine of hegemony. And there is no hegemony in this book. Nobody's playing those games.
No.
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. It's probably why I like it so much.
Yeah, I think this is one of those books where even like the main character isn't a single idea.
No. And he does evolve even though he doesn't want to. Or maybe not even. He does change. Yeah.
He goes through all kinds of changes all the way through the book. But I don't think this the comments that this book is making about religion and the comments that this book is making about race and society and stuff like that, it is one of those books where by reducing it down to such a small group and just one or two people or three people or five people or however small you want to get the group to be. And I think it's so powerful in that way that you can't apply it to you can apply it to the wider society, like saying, oh, and this is what this book tells us about Fox News and political commentary and things like that.
Yeah, but see,
I don't think that this book can it is for that.
I agree. There is no social contract.
Yeah,
there's no government. There's no none of the things we do as a group are in this book, except for very small examples of them. And so it's really about individuals interacting with one another, not a society coming into existence.
Yeah, I found myself, I was telling Luke while I was listening to it, I was saying, I kind of like the first part. I think that's really good. And I was very much getting depressed at the idea of spending a lot of time with families and yet it grew on me and the sweep of it, the slow pacing, what happened this year and what happened the next year and yet by the end, I almost think it should be Earth Abides is one part of the book, and then I guess People Abide, right, it's the other part. Because one of the things you can say is, no matter how bad we fuck up our environment, the Earth's going to be fine. I mean, it always has, always will be.
Yeah.
We could detonate every stupid bomb we have, and the Earth would be fine. Not right away, but in enough time.
Yeah, but
it's persistent. Life is persistent.
Right. In the time frame of the planet, I mean, we're just fleas on the back of this planet, and if it wants to shake us off, it'll be just fine and, go on doing what it's been doing for millions of years. So, and people do have an exaggerated view of how important we are, and this book really cuts that down to size.
Getting back to race for just a second, the one part of race that did come up, I was thinking about it as you guys were talking, or for a second anyways, when they decide to merge with that other tribe, right, they find this other tribe, and they have, I guess, real... I was saying a contract, but they just choose to interbreed with them, right? And then, so there is a division within the tribe. You know, are you born of another, right? And I guess that's your father is a – they decide for a paternalistic line rather than a maternalistic line. And that seems to matter to Isherwood a little bit, at least.
It didn't matter to anyone else, though.
No, it seemed he seemed to say, you know, we could have gone either way, but – or maybe that's George R. Stewart talking, saying the American system could have gone, you know.
Yeah.
It had to be paternalistic. And I was thinking, well, is that true? I don't know. That wasn't particularly clear to me. I mean, in a primitive society with especially no external threat, like no giant external threat, you know, other than the occasional bull that's you're on its grass – I think that the maternalistic line would probably take over all of this, and probably not Luke's area. Greg, your area is all maternalistic, maternal lined native, right? It's because the threat comes from other native groups rather than from, you know, some.
Correct. But no, I think Judaism, travels through the mother.
It does.
Well, Islam, it travels through the father. So I think you can just sort of pick it based on your slant. Again, observer's position in the
universe, the starting position. I thought, you know, in this case, I don't know, maybe because we don't hear much about the other people, but I like that how he says, oh, you look like one of us. And it's like, well, your group is so small. I guess it's only interbred like two to three generations, and yet you've got a look to you guys, right? And those guys have a look to them. And it's entirely possible that that would happen. Don't know.
Yeah. There were a lot of really nice touches in here, and it's definitely worth anyone who's listening to us definitely find this, read it, listen to it, whatever.
Well, before we go, let's talk about the hammer for a minute. What is it? A talisman? Totem? What is this thing?
I think it's a single jack.
It's a single jack.
Yeah.
It's a hammer from the Gold Rush.
Mm-hmm. I'm really disappointed that you actually gave its real name because we were talking about Jack earlier.
Good point. But I think it's more of a totem than anything else. It becomes a taboo, but it's a totem. It's a symbol of power. It's, you know, something you point to.
Yeah, but why that particular symbol? See, I get, you know, I could get, I mean, is it rebuilding? What is the? I mean,
it's just the opposite. It's smashing things.
It's power. It's power to destroy everything.
Yeah, he talks about Thor, I guess.
Everything that he uses it for is to break things apart. There's very, very few times where he ever uses it to drive in a nail. In fact, does he ever use it?
No, he does. He does. He does it on the library, I think.
No, he. Yes, true. But he uses it for all constructive purposes until you get towards the end when he starts banging on the granite stairs.
Yeah,
I remember they carved the numbers with the hammer as well. So, but that's part of a ritual, actually. But for me, it was like all the time he would pick if he needed a weapon, he would pick up the hammer. If he needed to bash something in, he'd pick up the hammer. And then when he had the hammer and he was like saying, "Oh well, I shouldn't have had this hammer. It's become a superstition for me too." Then he finds some use for it, which generally is smashing something.
It's specially placed. It's not, you know, he's. George R. Stewart put this hammer in the story. It gets a lot more detail than most, you know, tools. It's basically a magic sword for a fantasy novel.
You could argue it's the main character.
Yeah, I would say
that's a good. It's older than anything else, anyone else in the character in the book.
Yeah, this is why I wanted to save it, because I think this is the story of the hammer told from Ish's point of view, because literally it starts with him and this is why I said right at the very beginning, he finds a hammer and then is bitten by a rattlesnake. You know, I didn't have to say that at the beginning of this review when I was saying what the book is about, but I think it's very important that he finds the hammer. And I don't want to give too much away, but the story ends when he no longer has the hammer anymore. This, like you say, the book begins with him picking up the hammer, and the book ends with him putting down the hammer. I don't want to spoil it too much, but that is it. And I think that's not an accident, and it can't be an accident.
No, it's deliberately chosen. It's the most wonderful accident ever, right?
Yeah, it's a genius accident, and it can't be an accident. That's what I'm saying. If it is, it's like I have this picture of this spaceman on the wall on my wall. A listener to my podcast is a painter, and so I was like, oh, I really like your painting. So I got a print of it, and someone said, the spaceman with his arms outstretched, it is a reference to Jesus, isn't it? I'm like, I hope so. Because if there's an artist who has painted a picture of an astronaut, like with his arms outstretched in that way, and it isn't a reference to Jesus, it's like he shouldn't consider himself an artist. Oh, no, he can consider himself an artist, but it's like, yeah, it's one of those strange
things. Well, there's
things.
Only so many poses that you can do, right? I mean...
Yeah, this is quite biblical.
It's extremely biblical. But yeah. What I'm saying is, there's only so many poses that you can recognize from...
No, I'm just saying that. I think that the hammer is a constant companion of the story as it goes through, and it's used thematically in so many different ways and so many clever ways as well. Like I say, almost every one of the main themes of this book, is somehow represented by the hammer, or the hammer comments on it in some way.
Yeah, and I was worried when I first picked up that it was going to be a continuing thing. I'm like, oh man, is this going to be some hackneyed metaphor? And no, he did it. He pulled it off. It was great.
He did. But the thing is, I picked up on it literally as soon as he's like, oh, I pick up the hammer and I'll take it with me.
Yeah.
Like, I knew it was going to be a main thing in the book.
Yeah, me too.
And I don't know why, but it was just one of those things that he says, oh, this is a hammer. Shall I take the hammer? Yes, I'll take the hammer. And just that decision to take the hammer at the beginning of the book, and I thought, well, this hammer's going to come in handy later. But it wasn't. But I knew it wasn't just going to be a storyline. Oh, this is going to come in handy later.
Yeah, but it doesn't play the typical line, Excalibur is for defeating. It's more of... A symbol of some. I'm not sure. See, it doesn't play that definitive role of, a central magical object that's needed for some particular task. It's what I say about the word Jack, right? The word Jack means doer, the thing that does, right? So a guy who's named Jack he's a guy who can get things done. Black Jack or I don't know, Steeplejack or whatever it is. He's a guy out doing stuff. And that's why Jack Bauer is named Jack Bauer rather than Bill Bauer or something like
right.
that. Right. Because he's the guy who gets things done. And in this thing, it does everything, but it's also, it could have been done by a rock in almost every case, or it could have been done by...
No, I think it had to be something made by man. This is a semiotic sign that the guy's trying to send through the book. I mean,
I agree. Yeah. But
also he says at one point that he actually says at one point that this job could have been, and no, one of the other characters goes, well, you used the hammer. Well, you could have just used a rock for that. You didn't need to carry the hammer all the way. You could have just picked up a rock when you get there. And that's actually what another character says to him. And he's like, no, this is the hammer, And, again, it's like commenting on itself. It's like, the book is commenting and say, oh, the author is commenting about his own, choice. He's going, I could have used something else, but the hammer.
Yeah. But he does use it for insignificant things. He cracks nuts with it at one point. And so, not everything he does is important. That's why I like the fact that the symbol was balanced. It was a utilitarian functional symbol of the tribe, as opposed to some of the other tribes, because at one point towards the end, he starts talking about, and this tribe worships that, and this tribe worships that, and one of them is, a bunch of Jesus freaks, and I forget what they go through, but then his tribe worships the hammer.
Well, he don't say that he worships the hammer. He says they're led by an old guy who has a hammer, but nobody really cares too much about it. He actually says something like that.
I remember the word worship. Maybe I'm wrong, but
it might have been worship. That, but the point is that it's like unlike the Jesus freaks who are like all really into
we're
it.
Not sure, I'm not sure that they were Jesus freaks. They were just some kind of religious freaks.
Yeah. So there was like this hardcore religious cult, and there was these other people who think this, and there's these other people, and then it goes, and there was this other tribe whose leader was this old guy who mumbled a lot.
I think that was not George R. Stewart. I think that was the character thinking about his own situation.
Well, again, it's different. It's difficult to talk about it. Like, it's difficult to separate what's the voice of the author, what's the voice of the character. But at that point, he actually says quite specifically that the the character of the respect that the people had for him and his, or the leader of this tribe, obviously he's referencing himself, or he's referencing the main character, and the hammer isn't the same kind of respect that people used to have for, you know, crosses. You know, it's specifically right. that it's not the same level. It's more of a like, oh, it's a custom that the leader has a hammer, you know.
Right.
And it, by that time, it's not a big thing.
You guys have seen the Last Man on Earth, and there's a whole bunch of there's a blog I found the other day or earlier today called The Last Man on Earth, and it's a blog just collecting all the different stories. George R. Stewart's Earth Abides is in there. What I was surprised a bit about this book is it is completely different from all the other ones I've read. It's completely different from I Am Legend. I guess it looks yes. like a little bit like the movie in my mind. I was thinking, yeah, the streets are overgrown and the buildings are collapsing. There's a TV series called Life After People, which is pretty boring to watch, but interesting in, you know, to see a snippet of, right? The Manhattan's going to collapse first because it's going to be flooded out, right? Those pumps are in operation continuously, and if they're not in operation, it's gone. All those movies with, you know, the Statue of Liberty, maybe that'll survive, but all the rest of the city's gone, I think.
Right.
It feels different, don't you think?
I thought it was, yes, it was. It's very different. And I think that, you know, one of the most telling things I read about him was that he wrote a biography of Bret Hart. And if you think about Bret Hart's...
He's a Western writer. Is he?
Oh, that's what you think. He's not really. He was, you know, in San Francisco around the same time Twain was, and they were rivals, and Twain thought he was a crappy writer. But if you actually read his stuff, it's far more complex than, like, a Louis L'Amour. He doesn't write Westerns. He writes good stuff.
How do you spell Bret Hart?
Bretthart, I think.
T in Brett. I just looked it up because I've never heard of him. And I was like, what, who?
Oh, really? You guys got to check this guy out. I've done a couple of his stories, but I've read a lot more. He's got a really nice touch. There's always a little whammy in every single story, just what you're looking for.
Uh-huh.
Clever guy. They're not Westerns. You could set them in the West, but they're not Western.
Oh, The Outcast of Poker Flat. That's probably the only one of his I've read.
That's not a bad one either, yeah.
I think it is a Western, though, of some kind, isn't it?
Well, they all take place out here. I mean, it's just that's not really the central thrust of the thing. It's just just like The Earth Abides happened to take place in Oakland, but it could have taken place anywhere.
Maybe.
Well, all right, not... there are many places in the United States that are equivalent to Oakland.
Yeah, it could have been. Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
So yes, they're set in the West because that was his contemporary era. But they're no more Westerns than Twain's stories from that era are Westerns. You know, they're about people doing, you know, making hard choices and doing interesting things and stuff like that. But he has a very specific writing style, and I thought that I picked a lot of that up, that prose style up in Stewart. That calm exposition I was talking about,
mm-hmm.
Bret Hart does that too.
Is that book public domain? I don't know anything by George R. Stewart is public domain, is it?
I don't think so.
I'd love to hear that now that you're bringing it up.
Well, there's tons of Bret Hart out there, and there's even tons of Bret Hart on LibriVox.
I'll check it out. Get you to give me a list, and I'll start. I'll just look what you've done and download that.
I tend to do stories that nobody else has done. So I went way back and I did a bunch of his early stuff, a couple of early things. But his later stuff is definitely worth listening to more than the early stuff.
Okay.
It's just because I have this thing about not doing something that's already in the catalog.
That's perfectly logical.
Okay.
It is.
The people who suggest, who make suggestions to me.
I noticed in the latest production there was the what's a Kurt Vonnegut story that everybody's got to do. And I thought, oh, God, I thought we were done with those, but no.
You know, that's been very helpful to me, To Be or Not to Be. We have so many copies of it that I was actually able to figure out the average reading speed words per minute for all LibriVox. It's 148 words a minute. So
was it a suitable sample size, was it?
Yeah, and it's pretty amazing. I don't have it here in front of me, but this little story, you know, some people read it in 10 minutes and some people read it in 15. I mean, it's, you know, it's amazing the span of that. And there's a couple of stories in science fiction that we have that we just have a zillion copies of, and that's because people who first join LibriVox, they say, well, I don't want to do anything that's important that I might mess up. So what's worthless crap? I know, science fiction.
Oh.
And so they end up in my short science fiction thing for a story or two, and then they go off and do what they were actually planning on doing when they got there.
This is all going to be in the podcast, so be careful what you say.
Oh, I would say any of these things in public. I don't have any problem with it.
Can I say some really nasty stuff now, too?
Sure.
Sure.
Especially if it's about...
No, I don't have anything. I'll think of something in a bit.
Get a fight going. That'll bring up the ratings.
Yeah, I don't... I mean, you know, we all know that science fiction has been carrying this burden since the day it was born, so I don't think it's any great secret that people don't think much of it, you know, in terms of mainstream.
Is that because they're too busy not worrying about the question of why they're so dumb?
I think you've got a bit of a chip on your shoulder here, Jesse. I think you need to dial yourself down,
you know,
a bit.
Every time I see something that says sci-fi, or I was just listening to a podcast earlier today, and I thought it was going to be a little more. You know, even the people who are reading science fiction novels are still saying it. And the reason I don't like it is because of the association. It's so important, and yet they're treating it like it's, oh, this little thing that you know, it's like my hi-fi set or whatever. It's not a hi-fi set. Hi-fi set is not important, right? Hi-fi is a nice contraction, I guess.
But yeah, that's what amazed me about this guy who picked me to read his book for Iambic. I mean, if you look at my catalog, it's zap guns and bug-eyed monsters, you know. And this guy's like a pretty big literary heavyweight in New York. And he I said, apparently he heard something there that he figured it was, you know, okay for me to do it. And so I was shocked. I mean, I was absolutely shocked.
Are you going to use a different setup? We didn't mention this in the podcast earlier, but you're doing a professional recording. Are you using a different setup, like a, I don't know?
The problem is, if I could stay at home in my studio, mm-hmm. I would do that. But, you know, I'm on the road constantly, and this is a 600-page book, and so it has to be stuff I can travel with, and I can't travel with my $1,000 microphone.
Mm.
So, no, I'm using the same crappy shit that I use for LibriVox. And
well, you sound pretty good now. Is this your $1,000 microphone?
No, this is my cheap piece of shit that I travel around with. Microphone.
I'd like to hear the $1,000 one at some point.
Well, I'd have to send you some of my musical recordings. I don't really do audio.
You gotta do the definitive version of "To Be or Not to Be" by Kurt Vonnegut.
No one will ever do it in the catalog, my man.
All right. Well, I hope that means you're just going to continue to scoop everybody else as new stuff comes up. Because I saw you had done The Secret of Kralitz, was it?
Kralitz, yeah. Kralitz, well, Henry Kuttner. I'm big into Henry Kuttner.
Me too. And that's like his second published story or something, right?
Yeah. And I also did a longer one of his that's really good called The Ego Machine. I don't know if you caught that.
No.
Month or two back. Check that one out.
Okay.
Another one of my little two-parters that's like, you know, I like stories that are like, you know, 20,000 words and an hour and a half to 2 hours, that kind of thing. When I first started to do this, what I did was I sat down and I talked about this with Scott a little bit. There were a series of best ofs that Lester and Judy Lynn Del Rey put out in the 70s, I guess it was. And back then, I bought books based on bang for buck. And in the used bookstore, those best ofs were the cheapest and the thickest. So I ended up buying all 20 of them. And when
like
the best of
Lester Del Rey, best of Isaac Asimov, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but he didn't do himself, and he didn't do Asimov. He did Kuttner, he did Jack Williamson,
Block,
he did Phil Dick, Robert Bloch. Fred Pohl.
I've got a bunch of those myself, and I find them. That's true as well. In the used bookstore, you can't do better than grab a collection like that.
Yeah, so when I first sat down to say, you know, what am I going to read when I was starting with LibriVox, I went to the shelf, and I got those 20 names, and I put them at the top of my list, and I said, anything that comes out by these 20 names gets highest priority, and Henry Kuttner's one of them. So I did whatever I could find of his, you know, if it comes out. So So if you're looking for a method to my madness, that's what I'm doing. I'm working off of those 20 names that Lester and Judy Lynn gave me 30 years ago or 40 years ago now. So
it's good stuff. Let's talk. Maybe we're done with this book. Let's talk about future possibilities.
Are we done with it?
I don't know. Do we got more?
Well, I just wanted to say that because I'm going to release this episode of my podcast as well. I'm going to give it a really high rating, not quite 5 stars, but again a 4.5 star rating for me. I think because there was a few small points that I can't even bring up now about what I didn't like about it. But I think there was a few bits and pieces which I can't even think how this book could be improved. But
I think you get a better narrator for Connie Willis's introduction, and it's good. And
maybe
her reading is just the only bad thing, and it's not terrible. It's just not great.
I'll go back and listen to that again, actually. But I just think some of the again, but it's the things that I didn't like about it, which I think it's one of those choices that an author has to make for the better of, you know, the to make the book better. It's like you were saying, Greg, about there's this hammer thing. It's like, no, he's not going to do this, is he? And also what you were saying, Jesse, is like, no, he's just talking about his kids. I don't want him to talk about his kids. And then he wins you over. And I think some of those times when I was a little bit frustrated with it, then I realized actually he's saying something here, like by almost inducing a little bit of frustration in me about this part or that part, which is a tricky thing to appreciate in the book, because it sounds like I'm like being an apologist for a book that I really like by saying, oh, this isn't very good, but it's good because it's not very good in this way. Whereas most other books, if there was something that wasn't very good, I'd just say, well, that's just a bit shit. So it's a strange way to look at
one
it.
One of the ways you can judge a book, I think, there's a thousand ways you can do it. One of the ways you can judge it is, did it achieve what it set out to accomplish?
Definitely.
Absolutely.
And so, of course it did, right? But there's lots of crappy books that did what they set out to accomplish. And so they are, like, for example, The Incredible Shrinking Man by Richard Matheson is nowhere near as good as I Am Legend. Not because it didn't achieve what it wanted to do. It's just that a man that's shrinking is not a very good target. You know, it's not,
right.
What would it be like to be a shrinking man? Well, it achieves its target as best as possibly can be imagined, right? It's an excellent exploration of that idea. It's just that idea is shit, right? It's not a scientific idea. It's a psychological idea. And all the psychology that I'm interested in is much better played out in I Am Legend than it is in that book. Anyways, not to shit all over that book, but the thing is I think this book achieved it, whatever it was it set out to achieve, it achieved it, because I am thoroughly impressed.
Me too.
So I think this is a thumbs up from everyone, and I'm really glad that other people like recommended it, and then you said, we're going to read this book, and I'm like, oh, that's great. So I'm really glad that like the recommendations and your recommendation for this podcast, that I did it for this podcast, is really cool. And it's not that long either. How long is it?
It's 13 hours, I think.
13 hours. So it's not a long book. I mean, it's not a short book, but it's not it's not a hard read. It really does.
15 hours, I'm sorry. 13 CDs.
Oh, also, I wanted to mention a bit about time passing, and also different, you know, a bit about minimum population size and the loss of reading. Did we talk about the loss of reading? I can't remember.
A little bit, yeah.
No, a little bit, not.
Yeah. Not okay. Well, maybe
on
I don't
the scale
need to
that's in
no,
the book.
Go for it.
No. Well, I mean, I'm just thinking. It's sort of like it really does almost pose the question: is like reading, not reading, is it good or bad that people don't read anymore? I mean, I didn't know. quite what I wanted to say on it, but I just think it's such an interesting way of looking at civilization, that for the main character, Isherwood is like, for him, reading is the most important thing.
Yeah, that's why I'm empathizing with him, right?
Yeah, until about two, I don't want to spoil it too much, but until about 2/3 of the way through the book. And it's not, and then even counting isn't that important to him. Not even just reading, like,
right.
Yeah, they give up on, like, the calendar.
Oh, I didn't want to give that away, for goodness sake. You're just giving the book away, huh?
We'll just flow over that. I think that they're trying to separate the stuff you have to learn over and over again, like technique, like the stuff you would learn in books, from the stuff you learn by existing and being with other people and learning how to hunt and doing all those practical skills. And he does a good job of separating those two things and keeping them separate. And when you get to the end of the book, you realize that you can lose the technique because you're just going to learn that over and over and over again. But the skills you need to actually get along on this planet with, you know, the other things that live here are the really important ones. Yeah, right, like bulldodging. Exactly.
Actually, that did bring up one thing, but I'm going to have to do a little bit of research. So what books are you guys interested in reading next? I've been thinking about Make Room, Make Room. That's a new audiobook available on Audible, and I've got a paper book copy as well.
I'll definitely up for any Harry Harrison you want to do.
Luke, you read any Harry Harrison?
No.
Make Room, Make Room is famous for its movie. But
yes. Should we say the name of the movie or
sure.
Ruin it for him? Soylent Green.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I know the story. I'm not sure if I've ever read it.
Well, just get Charlton Heston out of your head and you'll be fine.
Oh, it's one of those. You're always looking at the imagery from the film and the ideas from the film when you're reading is it?
You could probably keep Edward G. Robinson, get rid of Charlton Heston. So it was Edward G. Robinson's last movie, and he does a good job in it. But the movie has about as much to do with the book as Omega Man had to do with I Am Legend.
Yeah, well, I get those all the I Am Legend films mixed up anyway.
Well, they're the same. They're both based on the same book, Omega Man. Yeah,
yeah. Okay. There's there's like three films. Last Man on Earth,
the Omega Man, and
I Am Legend. Well, based on Iron Legend.
I think closeness to the book, the first one's the best one.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to have to... I read I Am Legend before. I'm definitely going to have to read it again because it keeps coming up in so many different reviews that I want to talk about and so many different things that, you know, I think I need to definitely read I Am Legend.
Okay,
I'm just saying, I'm not sure, like, for this podcast, for the SFF Audio, like, read-along podcast, I don't have any suggestions off the top of my head.
We've got some stuff on the schedule, but I'm thinking, you know, for down the road.
Yeah, no, not really.
Okay.
Well, I would probably, I mean, you know me, I'd stick some Phil Dick on there.
Luke, you've been talking about Ubik. Have you done a review for that?
I started, I got two pages into it, but then I've been so busy doing other stuff. My life at the moment is just so bonkers crazy. And I've been, you know, doing other stuff and traveling and performing and so much that I've been, audiobooks are really great for that, but like actually carrying around a normal book, but I don't want to, it's actually a book that I want to read, you know, rather than listen to, I think.
Exactly. Exactly. So Ubik is the book I give to people to introduce them to Philip K. Dick. So I think that
and that's why I want to do it, because I've not reviewed any Philip K. Dick, and I've, you know, and when someone said to me, "Oh, what book would you recommend?" And I was just thinking, you know, of some of the best of his better known ones. I was thinking Man in the High Castle, maybe
Android Stream of Electricity,
but people say no, not those books. And I'm like, why not? And they're like, no, there's much better, more approachable books. And I'm like, right? And it's a bit strange that
you
got to
get into his mindset. You got to get into his head. But once you're in there, you can read anything he wrote.
That's the way that I was thinking about it. But Ubik is one that other people said.
There's a trilogy at the end of his life, Valis, The Transmigration of Timothy Archer, and The Divine Invasion. And those I would give you last because they're they are incredibly deep, and you do have to know a lot of background stuff.
I don't think I've read those. The thing is, all the titles are all weird, and it's one of those things. Hey, you know, there was this list of all the masterworks. Let me see if I can find this here.
While you're doing that, I'm going to talk about Tolstoy. So I took a philosophy of art course before I finished university. Not because I'm particularly interested in art, but because I find that follow the teachers. I don't follow the course. So if the teacher's teaching, you know, if this guy who's a really great teacher is teaching philosophy of art, hey, that's what I'm taking, right? And so I took it, and he talked about Tolstoy and Tolstoy's ideas about what art was, and it sort of rang through to me while I was reading this book. Tolstoy is kind of, you know, he's got a weird religious experience going on, but he also wrote about how the only true art is the art of the folk, right? The people on the farm, the people who live in the rustic setting. And, you know, you get out the accordion, you play that accordion for the dance, and you do the wood carving because that's what you do when, you know, it's a dark night and you can't go out in the rain or whatever. That's the only kind of true art there is. All the other stuff, the ballet and the, you know, full orchestra, that's not real art. That's inauthentic art. And I was thinking, you know, our main character, Isherwood, has a feeling, you know, he sort of comes to that belief as well, or at least George R. Stewart does. And I thought, you know, did you guys notice that, or is that just me?
I did sort of notice that, but my approach to it, I think, is different. I mean, to me, art is an abbreviation of the word artifact, and it just means man-made. So a nuclear bomb is art to me. So I don't, you know.
Okay.
My views on art are complex, and I have recorded hour-long podcasts of me just talking, expressing my views on art. So it's not the kind of thing I want to wrap up now in one line.
Right, and me neither. I mean, Jesse, you know I make stuff out of glass. So
right.
Right. Yes, so
very, very labor intensive artifacts. My God. Yeah, they're scary.
They are very scary. It's 2,600 degrees in there, and we use 300 or 400 pounds of molten glass at a time and stuff like that. So so I do have a lot to say about art, but I'm not saying it here, kids.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly my point as well. I there is lots of stuff I could say about art.
Well, let me ask you what George R. Stewart is saying about art then. In this book,
he makes quite a big deal about
how they're always carving, wood carving, and in the end, one of the kids near the end,
is carving a
statue, you know, that could have been that Venus, you know, the stone Venus from I don't know, ancient artifacts that you always see in books.
Oh, right. He's creating a fetish. Yeah.
Yeah, he's creating a sexy woman. Or a mother figure, whatever, ancient Venus, whatever it is. I mean, he's making it out of wood. He's not making it out of stone. But even so, that he's saying something about art, and I'm not sure I grasped it completely. Other than maybe he agrees with Tolstoy. Did you guys you notice that thread?
Personally, I never picked up on anything to do with art in this book about or what is art or even all the kids when they were carving and doing all of that. I never picked up on that as anything to do with art.
That was craft to me. It wasn't
art. Totally for me as well. It was about them learning skills that might become useful in the future, and it was actually quite good that they started learning how to use tools rather than just pick stuff up and just sort of like go to a shop and just find it in a shop. You know, at one point he says, oh, I could have just gone down to a shop and picked this up, but instead I've made it myself, and I encouraged the kids to make it themselves, and it became a game. And that kind of thing, absolutely nothing to do with art. I don't think art has a place in this book.
I think you're completely wrong. I mean,
okay,
look at a couple of the other symbols. Look at a couple of the other symbols. What are the young people, Jack included, use the coins for, right? They turn what is a mass-produced object and smash it away, right, into an object.
A practical use.
Practical object. Yeah. But it is of great interest to Isherwood to see whether that the original symbol is still on there. The original face is still on. Right. And it is. And he finds it good, right? The thing is that's sort of mass-produced art. There's something going on in here about art. And if you're not seeing it, it's just maybe you need to – I'm not saying you need to read it again. That's stupid. Okay, how about this? I saw it, and I'm pretty sure there's something going on there. I just don't understand it exactly. I think I need to read an essay about it or something.
I know that what my problem is,
I don't have enough material yet.
I don't categorize the same way. I mean, the oldest petroglyph in the world is, I see similarities between that and a Jackson Pollock. So I don't make those distinctions in terms of, you know, the art on the coin versus the wood cutting versus, I mean, I do see the wood cutting as craft. And I don't necessarily see the Republican art of striking a coin as the best example of art that you
can. I guess I am trying to draw you guys into a discussion about what art is. And I'm sorry about that. I didn't realize that.
That's okay. But if there had been a scene where he, you know, tried to save a Picasso from the San Francisco
there isn't
Art Museum.
That. You're right. It's not right. There.
Right.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think most of all these other things that we're talking about, like the hammer, like superstition, like religion, like race, like all these other different things that we talked about, that's actually something that isn't just talked about in the book, but it's actually commented on within the book that he is making a comment about it. And there are a few other things that we've picked out of this as well, which we can bring along to it. But I think that if he was going to talk about art, he would have actually mentioned something about art from the point of view of the main character.
Yeah, he doesn't really say, you know, art. I think it's one or two lines. I think there is one or two lines about art that, you know, uses the word. But there is this home craftsmanship. I mean, maybe it's inevitable in the book about this subject. I don't know. But I thought there was something there, even if it wasn't fully formed in the author's mind, it resonated with me for some reason.
My definition of art also encompasses being formed in the author's mind or not. So that's
exactly
the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And does the author's intent matter? You know, are we post structuralists and it doesn't matter anyway? So Jesse, you can see art wherever you want to see it.
Well, I think you talked about if it's made by man, it's an artifact. Well, what about found art then, right?
But Duchamp and those guys, they chose stuff around it. I mean, they didn't just...
Right, they turned it upside down, yeah.
They weren't Julian Schnabel, who puts a urinal on the wall. They actually had a piece, and within that piece was a found object. And I have absolutely no problem with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Borderlines are rough.
I'm just saying, for me, with art, it is almost entirely down to the intention of the artist.
The success of that intention? That's got to have something to do with it, too.
No, because it's a two-way street. I can't assume who's going to be looking at my art and what they're going to be thinking. I just have to assume the guy that consumes it is able to understand it on that level. If you pick another level that I never intended, that's okay. It's just not what I intended.
Okay, the computer software program that writes the novel that's enjoyable enough that, you know, that, yeah. I mean, then we can start talking about AI. I think there is some. Maybe we just have to do a whole separate podcast about art. I don't know. I don't know.
You need to check out Aristotle's Poetics, because that's what that program is based on. And it's a simple, it's like 80 pages. It's really easy. Go through it. And you will see the formula for virtually every movie you've ever seen. Okay? I mean, it'll just all come clear to you all at once. Just go get Poetics and read it. Everybody in Hollywood works off that exact same formula. And a lot of the same thing goes on in writing, too, except you have guys that try to stretch the envelope because they don't care as much about making money. But you know, you've got three acts, and it's either a tragedy or a comedy, and it's either, you know, I mean, it all boils down to this very simple set of procedures. And we make that same thing over and over again. How many times has The Seven Samurai been made? And the point
too many.
Is, well, the point is that plot strikes a chord with folk, with the common folk. You're getting back to your folk art.
We're getting back to the folk people, yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly where I'm headed with it. And so we will see the Seven Samurai made at least, 50 more times before we die. I guarantee it.
I think Yojimbo's been made enough, too, and I don't know.
True. Well, all the Kurosawa.
There's a couple of Kurosawa I haven't seen yet, so I can't say. There's one where there's a kidnapping. I'd love to see that one. I haven't seen that yet. But I think there's some stuff out there. Yeah, I guess Hidden Fortress. Okay, it's all being remade. Got it.
How about Rashomon? How many times have you seen
that? Okay.
Yep. I was just saying, for the Seven Samurai, I watched that, and I thought it was so slow and boring that I was actually really pleased to find out that I could watch it at double speed and then the subtitles would still work on the DVD player so I could just get through it. It was on two DVDs. It was one of the most tedious films I've ever sat through, but I thought, I have to sit through it because, everyone talks about it. And I just didn't find it enjoyable at all. But then again, that's just me.
So that's another question on the chart, right? Is Seven Samurai one of the greatest movies you've ever seen?
No, it's
no, but that's the question. That's the question that is the test. Is should you be my friend? Is if you answer yes to this, then
well,
maybe
now,
I'm
just
not sure.
A minute.
But see, the way is it would be an aggregate, right? It's like the diagnostic test for depression, right? So if you answer too many of the questions wrong, then I say, okay, this is not going to work out. We probably shouldn't be friends.
Mm. All right. Okay.
I'll put one on the list. I think the film version of David Lynch's Dune is one of the greatest movies I've ever seen. I can't tell you how many people agree with me. Maybe three in the entire universe.
I think it's true. You got four.
Okay.
I think it's a top notch movie. But as far as the Seven Samurai and that sort of thing is concerned, you got to think about these things in context. Okay. Let's say I like Like, for example, I like Laurel and Hardy, okay? And they were the first guys to do what they did. Now, a far more acceptable version of Laurel and Hardy is Gilligan and the Skipper.
Oh, no.
But they're not. Well, they were far more popular. They've been on TV longer. They're still in reruns, okay? So the fact of the matter is that we're talking about the first guy to do the thing. And Kurosawa was the first guy to do the Seven Samurai thing. The Magnificent Seven may be better because it was focused and aimed at us. But in terms of him being the first guy to come up with this universal plot that appeals to virtually every creature on the face of this earth, that's a tremendous achievement. And so I would definitely consider it one of the best movies I ever saw. But I agree with Luke that it drags now to my eyes in 2010.
Yeah.
But I do not take anything away from it because it was the first time that was done. And you've got these guys like Kurosawa and Fellini and George R. Stewart. George R. Stewart basically invented the disaster novel.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it, and it's so much better than, Airport 77.
So, I think the big takeaway for me on this is I want to read more George R. Stewart. I know none of his other stuff is science fiction, but that doesn't really bother me. If it's anywhere as good as this, yeah. There's one other audiobook out there available from Blackstone, and I'm not sure what it's about, but I was thinking of getting that.
Yeah, he will never let you down in terms of being interesting. You may disagree with him, but he's got an amazing catalog, fiction, nonfiction, everything he did, very jack of all trades kind of renaissance guy, and you should definitely check him out more.
Cool.
This has been the SFF Audio Podcast. Please join us at www.sffaudio.com.